Well, good morning. Welcome to our brunch event entitled Talking About God in a Post-Christian Culture. We're very pleased to welcome the Bishop Dr. Michael Nazir Ali here with us. On behalf of the parish of St. Albans Anglican Church, I want to welcome you. My name is David Robinson. I'm the assistant minister here. And in particular, I want to recognize a number of the groups that are represented here. The Laurentian Leadership Center, we want to welcome you, those of you who are here from Augustine College, and other campus groups, the Navigators, InterVarsity, the House, which is the young adults and student group that meet here at St. Albans, and others from the community. We're glad to have you here with us for this important theme. Some of you have already heard our speaker in his last couple of addresses. He spoke yesterday at noon on Parliament Hill, and also last evening at the invitation of St. George's Anglican Church, who are hosting him here for their 125th anniversary. He addressed their congregation as well as our synod at the Anglican Network in Canada. So some of you will have already heard him, but for those of you who haven't, I want to say a few things that will become immediately evident to you about our speaker and why it's appropriate that he address this theme today. Bishop Nazir Ali unites Christian postures that are too often separated. So on the one hand, he is a, shall we say, conservationist of the great moral and spiritual resources of the Christian tradition, while at the same time modeling and challenging us to a constructive interaction with the enormous advances in knowledge in today's world. He challenges us then beyond an insular or a reactionary conservatism to a more radical discipleship. He's also a courageous witness to the particularity of Christian faith, but as a thoughtful scholar, he models the crucial importance of dialogue and listening in the task of mission, and so challenges us beyond a safe, hasty witness, maybe a witness of antagonism, to more transformative encounters in our world. A few words about the spheres in which he works. Bishop Michael Nazir Ali has led the church in both Pakistan and in Britain, serving in the latter as Bishop of Rochester for 15 years. He's had numerous important roles in the church, such as serving as the General Secretary for the Church Mission Society and as Chair of the House of Bishops Theological Group. He's also had a number of important and interesting cultural intersections. He entered the British House of Lords in 1999, and he was a member of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority and chair of its Ethics and Law Committee. Dr. Nazir Ali is visiting professor at the University of Greenwich, member of faculty at the London School of Theology, and a senior fellow at Wycliffe Hall, Oxford. And his publications include Citizens and Exiles, Christian Faith in a Plural World, Conviction and Conflict, and the Unique and Universal Christ. A couple last examples of his cultural participation and indeed enjoyment. Bishop Nazir Ali writes and reads poetry in a number of languages and is a keen follower of several sports, including cricket, table tennis, squash, and to show his expertise at speaking to our particular cultural situation, hockey. Bishop Nazir Ali will speak for around 45 minutes, and then there'll be ample time for dialogue, questions, and answers. So on our theme, talking about God in a post-Christian culture, please welcome with me Bishop Dr. Michael Nazir Ali.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that introduction. I'll have to hire you to write my CV. I think you make it sound much better than it really is. But thank you for it. Of course, the hockey is field hockey, I hasten to say. Not there is a crucial difference. Well, thank you all for turning out. I hope the brunch has been worth it. I'm not quite sure about the talk, but I do hope that we can have quite a lot of interaction this morning as we meet. Of necessity, a lot of what I say will be about Britain and about Europe. And I don't pretend to a knowledge of Canada, and it'll be interesting to see how what I say about Britain and Europe actually also resonates with you. Clearly, there will be differences as well, and be interesting to hear from you what they are. But in Britain recently, we've had one crisis after another. We had the financial crisis when the people whom we had entrusted with our money were found to be unreliable, and many people lost money, of course. But the banking crisis was also a moral crisis. It wasn't just a financial one. I remember the Big Bang in London, not the origin of the universe, but the end, actually, of a Christian consensus in British business, where things like trust, responsibility, hard work were thrown out and instead were replaced with slogans like greed is good and so on. Well, in many ways, the financial crisis was the logical result of that kind of attitude. I remember being on a radio program with Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, who was making out that it was very important for bankers to receive very high salaries because they created wealth for us. And I had to intervene and say, look, in fact, they haven't created wealth for us. They've created debt for us, and not just for us, but for our children and maybe our children's children. Then we had a political crisis. I doubt if you have political crises in Canada. Do you? well, I'm sure you do. We had ours where, again, people we had entrusted with our political destiny were found to be fiddling their expenses in quite a serious way. And that is still going on, I'm afraid. even some of my friends in Parliament were found to be doing these things. And once again, there was a loss of confidence. And then in Europe, much of Europe and in Britain, we've had fragmentation in society, the emergence of isolated communities because of policies that I will mention in a few minutes, and the use by extremist elements of this isolation of some communities. Now, when these crises occur, politicians generally come up with calming words, don't they? They come up with words like respect or tolerance or good behavior. You know what all these expressions are. But I always think when they use these expressions that these values that they mention are not thick enough for our life together. They are what I've called thin values, with not too much weighting to them, if you like. So the question then is, if these are thin values, people will ask, well, what are the thick ones then? And I want to say something about that. But the question is, if there are thicker values than the sort of thin gruel that the politicians dish out quite often, where have these thicker values come from? If you consider the story of Britain before the coming of Christianity, what do you have? You have warring tribes, hostile clans, kingdoms that are constantly fighting either within themselves or with others, no stable society, and certainly no nation. So what made Britain, and this is also true of much of the rest of Western Europe, what made Britain a nation? What is that golden thread of harmony that made it a cohesive society? Now, some years ago, the European Union came up with a draft constitution, which thankfully proved to be abortive. I mean, I'm generally against abortion, but not on this occasion. And it had a preamble. I don't know if you remember. I know there are some politics students here. I don't know if you remember the preamble to the European Constitution. It mentioned everything. the influence of the Greeks and the Romans. You know, the gratuitous cruelty, idolatry, promiscuity of the Romans. That was not mentioned, of course. And the rather selective democracy of the Greeks, limited to men, excluding women, and of course, limited to free men, excluding slaves. Even Aristotle said about slaves, what were they? They were living tools, just as we might use this camera or this microphone or whatever, so you might use a slave. So the glories of Greece and Rome were mentioned, complete silence about Christianity. No reference at all. And yet it is clear, well, let's take Britain as an example, that nearly everything of value, the institutions, the laws, the customs of British society, owe everything to the coming of the Christian faith. Now, I just want to say how this is so, in two ways, I think, mainly. One is what Maurice Cowling, the great British historian, has called the descending theme. The descending theme, that is to say, how Christian faith influenced British society from the top down, if you like. And this had to do, of course, with St. Paul's doctrine of the godly magistrate, what we can expect from a godly ruler and what a godly ruler can expect from us. It had to do with the Ten Commandments. You know, across the border in the United States, they're busily removing the tablets of the Ten Commandments from courtrooms. Well, you can remove the tablets, but you cannot remove the influence of the Decalogue on the formation of the legal conscience, if you like, let alone the system. But it had particularly to do with the Christian doctrine of God, the Holy Trinity. In that doctrine, there is both order and mutuality. So the Son is not the Father. The Holy Spirit is neither the Father nor the Son. There is order, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. But there is also a mutuality of love, isn't there? This belief in the nature of God also affected the way in which society was organized, with both order and mutuality. Joan O'Donovan tells us, and she's a political scientist worth reading, that it was the idea of divine right or of divine justice that brought about a society where there was a combination of natural, human, and divine law. A society where there was an ordering towards justice and towards mutual obligation, mutual responsibility. Now, you will see immediately that that sort of society is quite different from the sorts of societies that we have in the West today. It would be interesting for me to know where you place Canada in all this. So there was a descending theme whereby Christian faith was crucial for the ordering of society. But then secondly, Cowling tells us that there was also an ascending theme, something that was coming up from below. And that had to do with the human person. More and more as people read their Bible, they realized that human beings were made in God's image. And this did several things. First of all, it showed them that human persons, I'm desperately trying to avoid the word individual, but maybe we should use it here, human persons were agents in this world. They could act and they could act in such a way as to make a difference to themselves and to the world around them. But also, they were not just agents, they were free agents. They had a certain amount of freedom, not absolute freedom, of course. That's only God's. But they had the possibility of acting or not acting in certain circumstances, or acting in one way and not in another. You were talking about poetry. There's a very well-known Persian poet called Rumi. You may have heard about him. And Rumi says on one occasion that if a brick falls on a man's head, he doesn't blame the brick. But if a man throws a brick on a man's head, then he certainly blames the man who threw the brick. You know, we instinctively recognize responsibility for action. And this has to do with not only agency, but freedom. Now, as agency and freedom began more and more to come to the fore, conscience became important. To recognize that people should act out of a well-formed conscience. You know, conscience is a given. Most human beings, all human beings, have some glimmerings of conscience. But conscience also has to be formed. It can't just be left as a native sort of faculty or capacity in us. And one of the tasks of the church in the Middle Ages was precisely that, to form conscience. But along with conscience, there then arose the view that if human beings really were free and had a conscience which made them behave in certain ways and not in others, then their consent was required in how they should be governed. You see, the top-down argument was no longer enough to say this is a society based on divine justice or on divine law or on natural law. The consent of people more and more was required in how they were governed. And so Magna Carta, for example, dates from that kind of period when this was increasingly beginning to be recognized. It is this view of the human person that became the seedbed for talk about natural rights. You know, so much of what is said these days in our society about natural rights or human rights is secularized. But that is precisely the word. It is secularized. It is not secular. The origins of natural rights talk lie in a Christian view of the human person. Now, this is illustrated very well, actually, in the story of the arrival of the Spanish and the Portuguese in Latin America. Well, not just Latin America, but let's take Latin America. As you know, the conquest resulted in a terrible exploitation, not only of the material and physical resources of these continents, but also of their people. And there was a move among the Spanish and Portuguese conquerors to deny the native peoples any rights whatsoever. This was on a number of grounds. Sometimes it was questioned whether they were fully human at all, or it was said that they were hostile to Christianity. Or it was said they were really like children. You've heard many of these arguments in other contexts. Against this, the Dominicans in particular held to the view that the Indian people, as they were called at the time, had certain fundamental rights which the Spanish and Portuguese conquerors could not take away from them. The work of Bishop Bartolomé Las Casas, you may have heard the name, is very significant, a bishop in Mexico, who fought incessantly against the Spanish and, particularly the Spanish, in his affirmation of the natural rights of the Indian people. Because he was a Dominican, his views began to influence the Dominican-dominated universities in Europe. Talk of natural rights began to be discussed and written about in these universities. Salamanca comes to mind. And it was from there that the moderate enlightenment, represented, for example, by John Locke, acquired the language of natural rights. Locke is an interesting person. I mean, what Locke was doing was trying to provide a new basis for Christianity in a world that had changed out of all recognition. The discovery of the new world, the rise of technology, a new way of doing science, and all of these things. And Locke began to write about natural rights in that context, borrowing heavily from the Dominican tradition about this. Locke, of course, was also himself a contradiction. So many of us are, aren't we? And whilst he was defending natural rights theory, he was himself involved in slavery and in the deprivation of the rights of Indian people in North America, because he had extensive property interests in Virginia. Now, when the evangelical revival happened, for instance, of course the evangelicals were reading their Bibles, and their view, for example, that slavery was a great evil, arose from their reading of the Bible and the teaching of the Bible that human beings, all human beings, are made in God's image, and so on. Similarly, their work in ameliorating conditions for working men, women, and children in Britain arose out of this commitment to a common humanity which they had derived from the Bible. But the point is that that evangelicals like Wilberforce and later Shaftesbury used terminology which they had gained from the moderate enlightenment to argue their case in the public sphere. And so in Britain, at any rate, in the 19th century, there arose what I have called an evangelical enlightenment consensus that is actually responsible for many of the institutions of modern Western societies which we take for granted. For example, universal education. I mean, universal education was not a creation of the state in Britain, but of the church. And the state was a relative latecomer to this commitment to universal education. The revival of the caring profession, such as nursing, explicitly took place under evangelical inspiration. And all these examples can, of course, be multiplied. The point to make is that this, in Britain at any rate, this evangelical enlightenment consensus, in other countries in Europe you might say a Catholic enlightenment consensus, this remained in place in Britain anyway until the 1950s. And the question is, how and why did it come to an end? What happened? And there are two theories about this, of course. The first is the long withdrawing roar of the sea of faith theory, that the process of secularization as your own Charles Taylor has said, was a long drawn out process. And it is characterized by a number of features. So, the gradual decline in religious observance, the lack of use of religious ideas in the public sphere, particularly the increasing dominance of scientific methodology, which led to many gains, but also resulted in a refusal to ask the questions why and what for. So science enabled us to ask questions like what sort of thing is this? The classification of inanimate and animate aspects of the world. It also was good at asking the question, how? How do things work? How does life develop? And all of those things. But it retarded, prevented even, the asking of questions about why there was something rather than nothing, for example. That's still the question that Stephen Hawking is wrestling with, of course, in his new book. And secondly, what for? Questions about destiny, about the old-fashioned word is teleology. What are things for? What are we for? What is the world about? One other feature of this process of secularization, which took place over this long period of time, was a change in people's understanding of the flow of time itself. You know, the idea of time in modern societies is derived from the Bible. That's one of the great gifts of the Bible to the modern world, because the Bible's view of progressive and open time is quite unique. You don't find it in other religious traditions at all, where quite often there is a cyclical view of time, of things going round and round and coming back to the same place. However, the Bible's view of time, as developed in the Christian centuries, was not flat. As time flowed, there were moments in time itself provided for which took people out of themselves, which reminded them of what was before time and beyond time. And it was the flattening of time which is a major feature of secularization. And I was saying last night in response to a question by someone that this is very aptly shown in how holy days became holidays. Holy days became holidays. Time was flattened. So there was a long process of secularization. That's one theory. There is another theory, and I believe these two theories are not contradictory but complementary. The other theory is the sudden death theory, that Christian faith in the public place died a sudden death, or a relatively sudden death, in the 1960s. And what happened then? Well, some things are worth noting. I think the first is that there was an organized attempt by neo-Marxist philosophers, thinkers, and activists to destabilize the fundamental institutions of society as a way of preparing for a political revolution. So names like Marcuse, or Gramsci or Lukács come to mind. This is why there was an unprecedented attack on the family, on the church, on parliamentary democracy, on judicial processes, all of those things. So that once their credibility had been destroyed, then the political Marxian revolution would arrive. Now, the point is that in much of the West, the political revolution never came. But the social revolution did, you see. And there were many people in the Western Academy who took on the social revolution on its own, apart from the social revolution being a prelude to something else. The London School of Economics is a very good example of producing many people who took on this undermining of traditional structures as an end in itself. Professor Anthony Giddens began to write about pure relationships. Rather than marriage and family, what were pure relationships? Pure relationships were relationships that existed only as long as and insofar as there was mutual consent between those who were related. Well, what does that mean? That means, basically, that there is a promiscuity in relationships. You can have them when you want them, and when you don't want them, you can ditch them. And that's precisely, of course, what happened. And the church was entirely complicit in this, I have to say. And even today, there are prominent leaders in the church who have written on, for example, marriage, family, human sexuality, using Giddens as a basis for their writing. And so they have said, I mean, these are church leaders who have said that human relationships do not need religio-social sanction to be authentic. Well, what does that do to marriage, for instance? Callum Brown, in his very important book, he's an agnostic social historian, the book is called The Death of Christian Britain, says that the demise of Christianity as a public force in Britain also had to do with the changing role of women. His thesis is that for hundreds of years, the faith was passed on not so much by the churches, and not even by the schools, but in the home. And it was passed on from mother to children. And for various reasons having to do with the changing role of women, that stopped happening. Women stopped passing on the faith to their children. I think that there is a lot of truth in it. That, of course, doesn't excuse the absence of men from the home, which is another feature of what was going on. Brown is, to some extent, right about this. There were other features of what was going on in the 1960s, the students were revolting. I don't know, you're probably not, most of you, old enough to remember that, but when I arrived in Cambridge, the students had just been evicted from the economics faculty, which they had occupied. And this happened in a number of universities, and when the students were asked, why are you occupying these faculties, they would say, because the university authorities have secret files on us. And so the journalists would say, well, where are these secret files? And the students will say, we don't know, they're secret. Well, you can work out that logic. But again, this was inspired by a kind of neo-Marxist plan to destabilize society for a revolution that was to come. Now, whether you take the long drawn out process view, or you take the sudden death view, or you take both, the point is that there is now a very serious moral and spiritual vacuum at the heart of most Western societies. You know, that's the reality that we are facing. And what, to my mind anyway, and I will be talking about this tonight, what makes this even more serious at this time is that since the demise of Marxism as a viable political philosophy, we are now faced with another comprehensive ideology, political, social, economic, that is challenging the world and particularly the West. I mean radical Islamism. Radical Islamism is avowedly and consciously based on a religious view of the world. Of course it is. And how will Western societies confront this ideology when there is a moral and spiritual vacuum at their heart? That is the question. But of course, it is not just radical Islamism. This moral and spiritual vacuum has created havoc in society. Ian Duncan Smith, the Minister for Works and Pensions, was saying in Britain just as I was leaving that the breakdown of the family is costing the nation £100 billion per annum. £100 billion. Children being brought up without their fathers, particularly. The role of the father, in fact, is now being written out of law in Britain. At the very time that all the research is showing that children relate to their fathers in a way quite different from the way in which they relate to their mothers. The explosion in street crime, in a lack of respect for the human person and the crimes that result from that. I mean, all these examples can be multiplied about the dysfunction that has been caused by abandoning the moral and spiritual tradition which gave Western societies its form and indeed its content. So the question is, what can be done? And I was saying last night that we shouldn't as Christians be arguing for a way back. I mean, that would be just taken as nostalgic and romantic and so on. What we should be arguing for is a way forward. And what is the way forward? Many people, of course, resist the any role for the Judeo-Christian tradition in the public sphere because they have organized their life in such a way now that it would be very inconvenient for them if this tradition put in an appearance again. I mean, we have to take this on board. There is a practical reason why people resist any talk of the Judeo-Christian tradition playing an influential role in the public sphere today. However, as I say, there is a vacuum. How are moral decisions to be made in the public space? Undoubtedly, I mean, I know many of you are engaged in policy making. These decisions have to be made. We can't say public policy is to be conducted without a moral dimension. In Parliament yesterday, we were saying that, I found certainly in my work with the Ethics and Law Committee of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, that decisions were made by default through opinion polls, for instance. So you went around asking people what they thought, and on that basis, you made decisions about how to treat the embryo, for example. Focus groups are another, perhaps even less reliable way of arriving at some kind of consensus. Or they were made by what politicians and policymakers call the yuck factor. What would the public be frightened by? And not to do anything that would frighten the horses, as it were. That would give material to the tabloids, for instance. And I found that these were all very unsafe ways of making important moral, political, economic, social, medical decisions. Take the yuck factor. I mean, I have found again and again that you take an opinion poll, say on assisted suicide. The vast majority of the public says assisted suicide is unacceptable. You then work on the public by producing hard cases, by gerrymandering opinion polls in such a way that eventually you get the right answer that you're wanting. This has actually happened in Britain. From an overwhelming hostility to assisted suicide, we now have polls showing a majority in favor. Within a few years. How did it happen? Now, the point is that instead of all of this gimmickry, the Judeo-Christian tradition actually provides a way for people to think morally in the public place. And take the dignity of the human person. A number of international declarations, the UN Declaration itself, before that the US Declaration of Independence, your Charter of Human Rights, all of them describe human dignity as inalienable. That is to say, it cannot be taken away from human beings. But on what basis do we say this? Why should we say it? At what stages of human life does this attach to the human being? I was involved in something that was called the Mental Capacity Bill a few years ago that the government had brought. It had originally been called the Mental Incapacity Bill, but the government realized this was an infelicitous way of putting it, so they changed the title, but not the content of the bill at all. The bill was really about the question whether it is ever the case that a human being can lose mental functions to such an extent that the normal protections due to a human person in a state no longer attach to this individual. And there was an outcry because immediately people began to talk about and to write about human dignity being inalienable. Cannot be taken away simply by circumstance. And I remember talking to a very well-known agnostic philosopher who's had a huge influence on contemporary legislation in Britain. And I said to her, on what basis do you say human dignity is inalienable? And she said, oh, well, it's that Judeo-Christian idea, isn't it, that human beings are made in God's image. So I said, well, amen to that. I mean, I believe that, but I'm very glad that you are appealing to it. But what it did show me was that even agnostic philosophers in certain circumstances have to appeal to transcendental principles. And it shows the importance of grounding these principles in a moral and spiritual tradition. And if not the Judeo-Christian, what else? This is also true, of course, about the very beginnings of life, the very end of life, how we provide for justice in society to people who are on the edge or shut in or whatever it may be. Secondly, the question of equality. See, that is another sort of big value that we are faced with in society. Couple of years ago, in Britain, there was established the Equality and Human Rights Commission. You probably have something like that here. I don't know. Do you? You have something. Right. Soon after it was established, I received an invitation to speak to it. I was very surprised. I said to my secretary, there must be some mistake. I'm not the sort of person an Equality Commission would ask to speak to them. But she checked and she said, no, they really do want you to come. So I went, of course. And what I found was very large numbers of people beavering away at the equality industry. But none of them seemed to know why people were equal. Why are people equal? On the face of it, they're not equal at all. They are differently mentally endowed, differently physically endowed. They look different. They're men and women. They're black, white, yellow, brown, from different cultural backgrounds. Why do we think that human beings are equal? You mentioned that I was the head of the Church Missionary Society, didn't you? Well, I was. And in the 19th century, the CMS had a lot of work in Australia. And its missionaries would go from one town to another, these settlements that were emerging, preaching and helping people with their faith and so on. And I was interested to note that quite often they took as their text that passage from the Acts of the Apostles where it says about God that out of one blood hath he made all the nations of men. And quite often these missionaries were run out of town because the white settlers did not want to be told that they were of the same blood as the Aboriginal people, who, of course, they were trying to exterminate. You see. The equality of human beings arises from the biblical teaching of common origins. The common origin of all human beings. Charles Darwin used to live in what was my diocese, and so when his 200th birth anniversary was celebrated recently, I was asked to preach the sermon. Yes, there was a service, and I was asked to preach the sermon, and the Darwin family were there, and the scientific establishment, and so on. So I had to do some research on Darwin, and I discovered some very interesting things. It's not the time to talk about them. But one of the things that really distressed Darwin, no end, was the unforeseen effect of the publication of The Origin of the Species in the birth of what I call scientistic racism. That is to say, the belief that the human races are unequal because they have different origins. This became very important in the United States, in the south of the United States, and was also the background to the racism that was found in European fascism in the middle years of the 20th century. But of course, the science of genetics has confirmed the instinct of the Bible, that human beings have a common origin. That is the basis for our teaching on equality. Similarly, liberty. I mean, this is another value by which we need to live. Dignity, equality, liberty or freedom. Again, grounded in the Bible's view of God's liberation of an enslaved people from Egypt. And it's not a surprise that oppressed peoples, so often African Americans, for instance, have found the Exodus trajectory in the Bible as fundamental to their own thinking about freedom. It's not an accident, is it? But not only that, the gospel itself, the gospel of freedom that invites people to be free and to respond to the gospel with freedom. Pope Benedict recently was asked by a journalist about this. The journalist said, for so many years, the Roman Catholic Church has been denying religious freedom on the basis that error has no rights. Why have you changed your mind? Why is the Roman Catholic Church now in the forefront of defending religious freedom? And the Pope said that, he said, in this we have gone back to the earliest part of our tradition, which is the teaching of Jesus himself. Well, it's a very good answer to give, I think. And wherever Christians have denied freedom, of course, that has been a denial of the gospel itself. But also desire by the Protestant reformers that everyone should be free to read the Bible for themselves. How important that was. William Tyndale, when he was translating the Bible into English, the aim was that even the plowboy, I mean, I don't know what the equivalent to a plowboy is in Ottawa, even somebody who works in McDonald's or whatever the equivalent, do you work in McDonald's? should be able to read the Bible, should be free to read the Bible. So liberty, again, is something that is grounded in the Judeo-Christian story. Safety from harm, you know, it is such an important part of legislation, safety. But in Britain anyway, I don't know about Canada, it has often been taken to be about the safety of the individual. Safety of the individual. And there was a very important debate in the 1950s between Lord Devlin, who was a senior judge, and an Oxford professor called H.L.A. Hart, about whether safety from harm attached only to individuals or to the fundamental institutions of society also. For example, the family. Does the state have an obligation to preserve the family from harm? Again, it is clear from the Christian point of view that it must attach to certain social institutions that are vital for the flourishing and the continuing of society as such. Now, I want to wind up very quickly. There are some people who agree that these values have come from the Judeo-Christian tradition. Very important book called The Suicide of the West by Chris Smith, who used to be a government minister in Britain under the last government, and his colleague, say, yes, these values have come to us from the Christian tradition, but now that we've got them, we don't need the tradition. You know, now we've climbed up the ladder, we can kick it away. Well, I've always found kicking away ladders a very dangerous sort of thing to do, because as soon as you've kicked it away, you find you need it again. And it is very doubtful that the values will survive without the tradition itself. What we are living on, in fact, is the vestigial, the residual. And just as the cat has disappeared, the smile on its face also will in due course disappear. Then the other thing that sometimes, particularly politicians, say is, yes, these values may have come to us from the Judeo-Christian tradition, but actually all religions produce the same values. You heard people say that? Well, do they? See, that's the question. Do they produce the same values? Take radical Islamism. The emphasis in radical Islamism is on solidarity, on social solidarity. The oneness of the ummah governed by a universal caliphate. It is not about individual freedom. And that is why you will continually find violations of such freedom, whether it's freedom for women or for non-Muslims or freedom of expression or whatever it may be. when I was working in a Muslim context, a Muslim friend who was not at all a radical Islamist, he said to me, he said, "Bishop, we never know when you're fasting." So I said, "Well, Jesus had said to us that when you're fasting, people shouldn't know that you're fasting." He said, "Yes, but in Islam, fasting is a social act." I was in Cairo during Ramadan, and my goodness, it is a social act. You know, everybody has to hear what is being said, whether you want to or not. Whether you are pregnant, elderly, a child, ill, there is no possibility of food in the public place during the hours of fasting. In public service, the Christian tradition has produced the values of service, of sacrifice, of humility. It is not the case that a public life should exhibit those values, whatever the religious tradition. It is quite possible to imagine a public tradition that emphasizes honor and shame, for instance, or the necessity of public piety, for example. Hinduism resulted in the caste system, which is a rigid way of social stratification, not equality. Buddhism is a very fine a very interesting example of the expression of human spirituality. But at its heart is the denial that there is such a thing as a human person. Yeah? So it is very unlikely that Buddhist-dominated societies will produce a proper view of the human person. What we have got in terms of individual freedom, of human dignity, of a belief in equality, is the result of a particular moral and spiritual tradition, not just of any kind of spirituality. And we ought to, therefore to value it. Now, two final remarks, and then I will stop. When we are faced with aggressive secularism, which tries to prevent the continuing role of the Judeo-Christian tradition in the public sphere, we meet it, I think, in two main forms. One is what you might call programmatic secularism. Programmatic secularism is progress without purpose. Tends to uphold values like dignity, equality, liberty, safety, but it doesn't know why it is upholding them. And the justification is always to make the values ultimate without need of further explanation, when in fact they cry out for further explanation. And then thirdly, it is libertarian. That is to say, it has a tendency to allow anything. Anything goes. Whether that is in terms of, excuse me. In terms of relationships, how you treat human beings, what you do, with the earliest and the latest stages of life, there is no moral and spiritual guiding principle. But then there is also procedural secularism, and quite often Christians and others are seduced by it, because what it appears to be is an invitation to an empty table. You know, everybody is invited to come and contribute, and somehow the truth is supposed to emerge from the contribution of all. In fact, procedural secularism itself has its own presuppositions and its own assumptions that are illegitimately smuggled into the debate. I mean, you will see this in parliamentary debate again and again and again. people are invited to contribute, but then you find actually that the decisions have already been made. The table really was never bare. There is no tabula rasa. So I think that's the sort of comment I wish to make about how we are to live as Christians in a secular age, and more importantly, how we are to be equipped to bring the Judeo-Christian tradition to bear on public life in our country. So thank you very much. You've been very patient. It's over to you now.
Well, you've been given a lot of material to work with, so we're now going to open the floor to questions and comments from you. I just ask that you keep your question or comment fairly succinct and to the point. And also to reiterate the bishop's invitation to you to speak out of the particularity of Canadian context. So a number of you are involved in steadying or perhaps retrieving the ladder here. So come and speak a little bit out of what's arisen in those encounters. While you collect your thoughts, and you can make your way to the microphone if you do have a question or comment, announcement to make. Unfortunately, these question periods are very brief, so we have two other events that I want to invite you to. One of them is this evening. It's entitled Faith and a Secular Age, Implications for Christianity and Islam. So furthering some of the bishop's comments on interfaith relations as well as the common challenge of secularity. And tomorrow evening, that one this evening is at St. Paul's University. Tomorrow evening we have one entitled The Coming Global Christianity, Mission, Persecution, and Growth. So more stories from the work in mission and stories about the global church that you'll be interested in, I'm sure. So let's open the floor to questions. You can come to the microphone. Sorry? Yes, tomorrow night it is at St. George's Anglican, and it'll be in the context of an evensong Anglican service as well. So more information will be available downstairs. We'll have brochures and come talk to myself or Greg if you'd like some more.
Thank you so much, Mr. Gonzalez, for this really deep, well thought out, and great talk in our time.
I was just had a question about kind of this new militant atheism, and I find, especially in the last maybe 10 years, even like with the rise of Christopher Hitchens and all of that sort of thing. And also in my own work, I published a couple articles. I worked for a Christian organization, and I published a couple articles on human rights. And I got feedback just like really, like, you know, calling me a hypocrite, calling me, you know, I don't believe in human rights. I believe in just oppressing people. But at the same time, I wonder if that militant atheism, if that gives rise to any hope in that maybe people are paying attention more, like there might be something there, so people feel they have to fight back. So I don't, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, there are so many strands to what you're saying. I think the first thing is that quite often Christianity is the target of aggressive secularism because I think deep down these people know that Christianity is actually the only other viable worldview. So you get this strange situation of great respect for other faiths, but a tremendous sort of aggression against Christianity. And I think that's the reason, because they think or they know that the other faiths cannot, you know, they can be interesting sort of ethno-religious things, artifacts or whatever, but they don't pose a challenge to the secularist worldview. It's only Christianity that does that. That's I think, quite a significant aspect of the hostility. To say you're hypocritical and so, I mean, that's just abuse. That's not argument. And sometimes abuse takes the place of argument, I'm afraid, in these situations. In the end, militant atheism fails, just as Marxism failed, because it is deterministic, you see. And if you take the atheism of a Dawkins or a Hitchens or an Atkins, the logical result of what they're saying is a determinism which removes any kind of uniqueness to the human condition. You know, whether they accept it or not, it does. There is no way, if you accept their arguments, why human beings should be treated in any special way whatsoever. And so Singer's charge of speciesism or whatever he calls it, then rings true for people. You know, that means to say killing mice to save babies is wrong, because there is no way in which you can say that human beings have more value than mice. I was doing a program called The Soul of Britain on television, and it started out with a debate between three of us. There was Professor Peter Atkins, who is a colleague of Richard Dawkins, who is a determinist, a physical chemist who's a determinist, an astrologer from the Daily Mail, and myself as the Christian. You know, it's just, that's the world we live in. That's the world. So anyway, Peter Atkins, this scientist, and I combined forces to get rid of the astrologer. And then, of course, we were left. And what I said to Peter, who has become a friend since then, I said, on the basis of your determinism, which is a kind of determinism based on his discipline of chemistry, you must deny both human agency and human freedom. I can't see how you could say that whatever I think and I do is the result of chemical reactions in my body and still be able to affirm real agency, a real ability to make a difference or not to make a difference in this world, and real freedom. And he just did not have an answer to that. And I think this... you end up with the kind of ridiculous philosophical position like Singer's if you push this kind of militant atheism too far. Taking Stephen Hawking and his... It's interesting that he's called the book Design of the Universe. Why design? I mean, in fact, the argument of the book is that there is no design. Professor John Lennox has given a very good reply to Hawking when he says that Hawking has mistaken the descriptive nature of the laws of the universe to be explanations of the reason for the existence of the universe. In fact, the laws demand an explanation as much as the universe itself. And where is that explanation from such a prominent cosmologist? I think Lennox prefers, and I certainly prefer, more open cosmologists like Paul Davies, who, although not Christians, nevertheless remain open to the universe being purposive, if we are going to make any sense of it whatsoever. Yeah, thank you. Oh, this is the bishop's chair. Thank you.
My question might be a bit broad, so feel free to take it however you want. But one of those institutions, certainly in Britain, I think, that was built with that ladder of Christianity is the university. And I was wondering if you had any comments on how the removal of that ladder has affected that environment and how it may change in the future as the Judeo-Christian tradition becomes more and more absent from it.
Yes, there are a number of ways in which we can respond to this question. I think, first of all, it's the idea of the university is itself a Christian idea. When I came in, the hymn that was being played here over the system was "Praise to the Holiest in the Height," the Blessed John Henry Newman's hymn, of course. And his essay on the idea of the university still remains, I think, the single most important thing written about the university in the last two centuries. I was very interested that a recent vice chancellor of Cambridge University, who was quite a secular person, when she wrote her paper on what she would do as vice chancellor, three out of the four references were to Newman, and the fourth was to the Bible. You see, there has to be some organizing principle for knowledge, if that is what universities are about. The Judeo-Christian tradition has not only brought universities into existence, but more importantly, I think, it has provided the organizing principle for the pursuit of knowledge. I was a friend, and I counted it a great privilege to be a friend of Professor Joseph Needham, who was, I think, the greatest sinologist in the Western world. Sinology being not the study of sin, but of China, of course. Joseph Needham was not a Christian, but the question that he was increasingly concerned about as he grew older was why China, which had been so far in advance of Europe as far as science was concerned, fell back at the beginning of the modern period. What were the reasons? And Needham very reluctantly came to the conclusion that the reason was that Europe had the Christian idea of an ordered universe with laws that governed it and with predictability that allowed science to develop in the way in which it did. And certainly this Newtonian paradigm of an ordered universe with laws remains, even with quantum and so forth, remains at the basis of the possibility of science. So I think if you abandon this organizing principle for knowledge, what you then have is a continual fiddling around assessments of various kinds, emphasis on new research that people then have to show is new, rather than valuing knowledge for its own sake. And I mean, you find this in universities everywhere. In Britain, certainly, the coin, the university coin, has been very debased, and to the point where I think we now have to think again of distinctively Christian universities.
Over the last few sessions, you've touched on the political landscape, how it's changed in North America, literally around the world. And you've touched on slavery and also social affairs, social policy that some are studying and working on in different parliamentary settings, if you will. In regards to human trafficking, human smuggling, I would like to know from your point of view, because I do realize that based on a little conversation we had yesterday, you mentioned how you have been working on this issue and topic, but I'd like to know what the church thinks of prostitutes. Because here we are having so much compassion for the for those that have been put into containers or trafficked in by different means, but the prostitutes we talked about, they are entrapped. And so I'd like to see where your take is on that.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that human trafficking must be seen in the wider context of the oppression of human beings. When I was a bishop in Pakistan, one of the things that I got involved in was bonded labor, you see. Now, bonded labor is not human trafficking in the sense that you're not taking human beings from one part of the world to another. But nevertheless, it's a kind of oppression which has some similarities with human trafficking. And I found in my work with people in bonded labor that those to whom they were bonded were quite happy for me to go in and say spiritual things to these people. But as soon as I started talking about education, as soon as I started talking about a way out for them in terms of living away from their place of work, the possibility of that, then all hell broke loose. You see, those who more or less own these people didn't want any of that. Australian television actually made a film of this. Caroline Jones, who had been an atheist broadcaster in Australia, had at that time very recently become a Christian. And she came and made a film about how the gospel confronts this kind of oppression. And I think the question, whether it is bonded labor or human trafficking, is this question about human dignity. That whatever else we say and do, this is not negotiable because human beings are made in God's image, however degraded they may have become in the processes to which they have been subjected. And my goodness, they do become degraded. I mean, this is not talking about nobility. You know, these processes actually affect the moral and the moral behavior also of people in this situation. If you talk particularly about prostitutes, on the one hand, Christians will want to affirm the human dignity of people involved in prostitution, of course. And that may lead them to engage with such people to bring them away, as it were, or to free them, perhaps is a better word, from what they have got involved in. But quite often that is not so easy. And prostitution has become endemic to people's lives. And then what to do? Then you have the lesser evil thing, where you seek to help people without endorsing what they are doing, but nevertheless recognizing human dignity and helping them in the way, in a way that is possible. There are all sorts of dangers in this, and I have personally not been involved in work among prostitutes, but I know many people who are. And to maintain a spiritual integrity in this work is quite difficult. On the one hand, without seeming to reject the value of these people who have become involved in this work, but on the other hand, not to endorse it, not to seem even to be saying, well, it's all right to carry on like this. so many brave Christians, for this reason, provide for a way out for prostitutes, whether it is a halfway house or employment opportunities, or the possibility of marriage and family. And all of this is worthwhile, but the rate of failure is very high. I mean, that also has to be acknowledged. I think St. George's Church has as its motto, doesn't it? It's what is the motto, Gregory? I think that's the challenge, transforming broken lives, and no lives are more broken than those of those involved in prostitution. But there are many, many stories of people who have been involved in the business of prostitution who have indeed been transformed and who are now in fellowships, Christian fellowships, contributing to it, and sometimes themselves working to change other lives. We give thanks for that. I mean, this does raise a question. I don't want to address it at the moment, but it is a question which I think sometime you should address, is how the gospel actually transforms lives. There is quite a lot now of scientific, social scientific study in this area, which is worth looking at, because what might be true of Pentecostals in Latin America or untouchables in India or whatever, in terms of the transformative power of the gospel, maybe mutatis mutandis can also be applied in other areas.
We have time for one more, so if you'd like to.
My question is, you discussed the moral vacuum that's happening in the public sphere, be it political or in the universities. However, there also seems to be a movement away from being able to base any idea on scripture, that as soon as you bring that up, people back off and are unwilling to accept it, the idea itself. And so my question is, how do we, as Christians who are meant to bring forth the Judeo-Christian values into the public sphere, how do we do that without turning people off by basing it on scripture, or basing it on just by saying we should do this because it's a Judeo-Christian value?
Yes, and there is a long tradition of how to do it. But I think simply put, what we need to say is the Bible teaches such and such, for example, about marriage or the sanctity of human life, because this is the way in which human beings flourish. So I would never say marriage and family should be upheld in society because the Bible says so. What I would say is that the Bible teaches the importance of marriage because all our experience shows, and indeed contemporary research shows, this is the way in which children are best brought up, or this is the way in which people find fulfillment in their relationships, or this is the way in which the basic unit of society is best expressed, or something like that. So never just the Bible says so, but the Bible says so because.
I'd like to thank you, Bishop, for your substantial thoughts and as well the leadership that you're taking in these many areas. Would you join me in thanking our speaker?